This is your home for Progressive Talk. AirAmericaRadio.com.
Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, the Post-Times Sun-Dispatch reporting that Fox News is going to be doing a half-hour expose on me. I'll tell you about that in a little bit. Yes, it's an entertaining story. President Musharraf, Benazir Bhutto, quite upset, among others. We'll get into that. There's a lot going on in the world. Tomorrow on the program, Ambassador John Bolton will be with us, and Laura Flanders. Today, in our second hour, Mark Green, his book, Losing Our Democracy, How Bush, the Far Right, and Big Business Are Betraying America, and How to Stop It. In our third hour, we're going to have about a 45-minute conversation with Naomi Wolf, The End of America, a letter of warning to a young patriot. It should be interesting. Right now, William Clark is with us. Paul Kengor is with us. He's the author of a new book about William Clark. It's called The Judge, William P. Clark, Ronald Reagan's right-hand man for all practical purposes. Paul Kengor, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom. Thanks.
Good to have you. In fact, the subtitle of the book is Ronald Reagan's Top Hand. I have the book right here. I've spent some considerable time with it. First of all, there's two things. One, in the news release that came out with the book, you took quite a swipe at Hillary Clinton, saying that there is no candidate, none, in the history of presidential politics as radical as Hillary Clinton, and going on to say that she must be defeated. I'm wondering why you do that in a news release about William Clark, who was Reagan's top aide and ultimately national security advisor for so many years.
Yeah, actually, maybe we should have talked about this beforehand. I wrote an op-ed piece on Hillary and abortion, and I mentioned in the tagline of the piece that I've got two books out, one on the faith of Hillary Clinton and the other on Bill Clark and the judge. So that would go more with the book on Hillary.
You might want to talk to your publisher, because they've got the Hillary information in the press release that comes along that we received with the book on Bill Clark.
Okay.
So anyhow, just a heads up. Well, Nikki's,
Then
let's talk about William Clark.
Sure.
Here's what I don't get. It seems to me that William Clark was a party to, in many ways, a number of what, according to the September 30, 1984 Brussels Tribunal conclusions, and I'm assuming you're familiar with that, the convention that was actually moderated by a whole bunch of Nobel laureates, Sean McBride from Ireland, George Wald, Nobel laureate from Harvard, Ugardo Jarin, Nobel laureate from Peru, it's just a huge list. That the Reagan administration was guilty of a number of crimes, very specific crimes. The invasion of Grenada, for example, violated the UN Charter Articles 2, 3, 2, 4, and 33, as well as Articles 18, 20, and 21. The UN ruled that as well. The threat of invasion of El Salvador and Nicaragua was illegal. The intervention in El Salvador was illegal. Violation of Article 1, Subset 2 of the UN Charter. The participation in military operations in Nicaragua was illegal. And the International Court of Justice, pulling out of that and refusing to acknowledge their jurisdiction when they tried to stop Reagan with regard to Nicaragua was illegal. Mining the Nicaraguan harbors was illegal and condemned by the United Nations. How can you write so glowingly about a man who arguably was a war criminal?
Well, Bill Clark left the national security position on October 13, 1983. We invaded Grenada on October 25th, 1983, so he actually was a national security advisor yet at that point. In fact, Clark, what really stands out about Clark's period at the National Security Council, he began January 4th, 1982, and he left in early October 1983, is that Clark actually, his most notable mission in all of South America, Latin America generally, was a secret mission to Suriname that we report for the first time in this book. It occurred April 1983. involved Clark and three or four other people, and they went to, it's amazing how Suriname, which most people can't even find on a map and have never even heard of, an almost identical situation to Grenada, where the Soviets were involved, Cuba was involved, there was even a Libya connection, and in fact, because the United States had an Alcoa plant down there, there was even a possibility we feared of a hostage situation like the Reagan administration feared with the medical students in Grenada. So Clark goes down there in April of 1983, and by down there, I don't mean Suriname, but Suriname's neighbors, Brazil and Venezuela, to do everything he can to get Venezuela and Brazil involved in a way that would require us not to use military force.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought that this was a very impressive operation that had been done where a Grenada wasn't pursued. A Grenada didn't happen.
So this is a
lesson
really.
That's good without force.
George Bush needed Bill Clark.
Well, actually, I'll tell you what. That's a good insight. George Bush could use a Bill Clark. And Clark comes from a long generation of ranchers and sheriffs and lawmen from California. I mean, his grandfather was a famous sheriff at the turn of the century, the early 1900s. Father was a famous sheriff. And Clark takes great pride in the fact that neither of these two ever killed a man as sheriff.
So you're suggesting that after Clark left his tenure with Reagan, that's when the Reagan foreign policy devolved into the what has been referred to as cowboy diplomacy by you know most Europeans, if not the domestic critics of Reagan.
Well, to an extent, and in fact, this is very interesting. Another reason we felt that we should write this book and tell this story is that many people believe, from the right to the left, from Lou Cannon to Cap Weinberger, that if Clark had stayed on at the NSC, the whole Iran-Contra thing may have never happened.
Well, I found that very interesting. I read the chapter in your book about Iran-Contra.
Mm-hmm.
And the decision to start selling weapons to Iran, so to supply weapons to Iran, happened in early 1981, within months after the election.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, there were no U.S. hostages anywhere.
Right.
And in your book, you suggest that as this kind of came out in, what was it, 85, 86, as I recall, that, you know, there was this concern there were these hostages here and there. But the fact of the matter is that at the time the decision was made to exchange weapons for hostages, there were no hostages. And this has caused many people, including people like Barbara Honegger, who worked in the State Department, in Reagan's State Department, wrote a book about it,
mm-hmm.
To suggest that, in fact, this was payback for a deal that Bill Casey cut with the Iranians to hold on to the hostages through November and December, or through October and November of 1980 in order to help Reagan beat Jimmy Carter.
The October surprise.
Yeah. Well, and your book doesn't, you know, the timeline in your book doesn't refute that at all. I'm wondering, you know, obviously you're familiar with it.
Sure.
Why didn't you take it on?
Well, because...
Or do you think it's possible?
Sure. Well, all of 1981, Clark is at the State Department.
Mm-hmm.
1980, he's on the California Supreme Court, so he doesn't even get to Washington until February 1981. He's national security. Again, he's at the NSC for all of 1982 and most of 1983. So, I mean, without going into those specifics, all I can tell you is that Clark wasn't involved in those things.
Yeah. Well, what about, you know, Bill Casey? I mean, he was Reagan's campaign manager.
Right.
The day that he died, and in your book, you treat it very gently. I mean, there's just a couple of pages about it. You talk about he was a good guy and it was a tragic death. He had a seizure at his office at the CIA, fell on the floor, had a seizure. They took him to the I think it was Walter Reed, or it might have been the hospital in Baltimore. In any case, and they removed the part of his brain that was responsible for speech. They rendered him incapable of speech, and about 6 weeks later he died. That was the day, that afternoon, that he was supposed to testify about Iran-Contra. And his lawyer, Milton Gould, is on the record as saying that Bill Casey was going to say that he had participated with George Bush Sr. in basically cutting a deal with the Iranians to hold the hostages to help Reagan win the election against Carter.
Well, look, if I was writing a book on Bill Casey, that would be in there. But the book is on Bill Clark.
Yeah.
And Clark's involvement with Iran-Contra, or non-involvement, is really picked back up in December 1986 when he's at a Department of Interior memorial occasion where they're unveiling his portrait and everything, and he gets asked about it for the first time. And then at that point, he comes in and starts urging Reagan to do pardons and that sort of thing.
Right.
I can only stick with Clark. I can't talk about Casey's involvement. I didn't even look into that. And I mentioned Casey, as you say, glowingly there in the end, but only because Casey is Clark's friend, and I'm telling the story of Clark's life.
And Casey's early life is, I mean, he was a real hero in his early life, you know, with the OSS and the CIA and everything. He did a lot of good stuff. Anyhow, the book is The Judge. It's about William P. Clark, Ronald Reagan's top hand, the author Paul Kengor. Paul, thanks for being with us today.
Okay, Tom.
Interesting conversation and an interesting book. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Sing a song of taxes. Working class cancer sore. Tea in Boston Harbor. Revolutionary war. Of giving to the rich and taking from the poor. Sing a song of taxes, let's even up the score. Sing a song of taxes in the presidential pew. Throw in grease senators and corrupt congressmen in the brew. Add a depraved governor, the Education Regency Board. A few greedy city council members and Attila the Hun's great horde.
21 minutes past the hour. Strange things out there in the world. Could be this from the blog of R.J. Shulman, the Post-Times Sun-Dispatch. As they say, don't let a day go by without PTSD. Anyhow, here's the headlines. Fox News documentary, Tom Hartman hugs trees, then writes countless books that causes them to be chopped down. The Post-Times Sun-Dispatch has learned that Fox News is going to air a half-hour documentary called Tom Hartman, Environmental Hypocrite and His Secret War Against Trees, in which the Air America talk show host is accused of promoting environmentally friendly positions, but then authoring a string of books that needed a slew of trees to be harvested for paper. Hartman has released Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, and Cracking the Code in just the last 2 years. If he loves the environment so much, says Britt Hume in the documentary, he shouldn't even be reading books, let alone publishing them, causing whole forests to be devastated. Bill O'Reilly says, just like that fake environmentalist Al Gore who uses electricity and flies on planes, Tom is one of those liberal hypocrites who wants to communistically stop the free market from making the best use of trees, but has no trouble when a tree is felled to make paper to be used to print their personal propaganda, which will find its way into the hands of all those people who don't listen to liberal talk radio. The documentary is set to air next Thursday, right before the documentary on John Edwards called John Edwards, Poverty-Supporting Hypocrite Who Refuses to Take a Vow of Poverty Himself. Yeah. Well, thank you, Bill O'Reilly.
And, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Now, while, you know, Bill O'Reilly's little riff there is actually from Bill O'Reilly, the news story I just shared with you is from a spoof site, p-t-s-d.blogspot.com. And thanks to R.J. Shulman. Strange stuff. The real story behind the casualty rate in Iraq. By the way, I just want to close up this thing on Ronald Reagan. The continual reinvention of Ronald Reagan, who I think, in my opinion, was one of the worst presidents of the 20th century. The guy who began rolling back the New Deal. The guy who began the destruction of the middle class. The guy who began the policy, the modern day policy, of invading countries preemptively like Grenada. Yes, it was on a small scale, and yes, it was done for political purposes as a way of distracting people. The guy who may well have stolen the first major, serious, real, documentable election theft. And in fact, when Congress was empowered to investigate the Iran-Contra affair, the law that was passed that allowed the investigation specifically said that they could not look at anything that happened before 1982. So they could not look at whether or not the weapons that were being given to Iran were being given in exchange for Iran holding the hostages as opposed to releasing them. And so, anyway. The real story behind the falling casualty rate in Iraq, Brandon Friedman over at the Daily Kos, a great post, a great blog. What he's pointing out basically is that deaths are down in Iraq right now, and it appears that the reason why has nothing to do with anything that the United States has done. It has nothing to do with any surge. It has nothing to do with our activities. He says, instead, as the New York Times wrote, this is back in August 7th, the New York Times reported, first of all, that we were having, you know, fancy new roadside devices and all this, deadliest weapons yet used against us almost exclusively by Shiite militants. This was Muqtada al-Sadr's guys, al-Sadr. In response, 3 weeks after the New York Times article ran, 50 Muslim pilgrims were slaughtered in sectarian fighting in Karbala. So Muqtada al-Sadr announces that he had, quote, ordered his militia to suspend offensive operations for 6 months, end quote. And all of a sudden, U.S. deaths started dropping off. As Brandon Freeman points out in his blog over at the Daily Kos, he says, no one saw this coming. And then, again, quoting from the New York Times, a surprise statement regarding this notorious Mahdi army, which is responsible for much of Iraq's sectarian bloodletting, not only caught British and American commanders off guard, but appeared to have surprised Baghdad officials as well. We'll see. If it's good news, it's true. But if it happens to reduce if it happens, it will reduce violence in the country a great deal, is what Mufta al-Rabl, Iraq's national security advisor, said. So, you know, people saw this coming. And this was reported on August 3rd. Nobody really believed it. Nobody took it seriously. August, let's see, September, October, November. And apparently Sadr has done this. And as a consequence, American casualties are dropping. And Bush is claiming credit for it. And it's got nothing to do with Bush. Very much like Reagan used to, you know, oh, yes, we're going to take down the evil empire of the Soviet Union. I'm sorry, the Soviet Union was collapsing under its own weight. At what point are we just going to stop allowing the Republicans to reinvent history and start pointing out the realities of what have happened? You know, that for example, if Jimmy Carter had gotten reelected, if those hostages hadn't been held, because Carter was clearly the front runner right up until about the last 6 weeks, and it was the hostages that took him down. Carter had been reelected, we would not be in the Middle East right now because we would be oil independent. 27 minutes past the hour. Your call's up next.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
My kids don't read and my kids don't write. I'm stuck in a traffic jam every night. The crime rate's up. But that's all right, 'cause I got low taxes. Low taxes like they have in Mississippi. Low taxes, that's what I live for. Low taxes. You bet your sweet Bippy, I hear those low taxes singing my song.
Yes, low taxes, ain't it great? Well, actually, it's low taxes for millionaires and billionaires. You know, Reagan doubled the Social Security tax on working people. But millionaires and billionaires saw no doubling of their taxes because back during Reagan's time, I think it was around $33,000, $34,000 a year you had to make at that time in the early 80s when he doubled the Social Security tax so that this would be the first generation that pays not only for its parents' retirement but also for its own by creating a savings account for itself, the baby boomers. And then Greenspan, a year later, when Reaganomics wasn't working and was going in the toilet, Greenspan said, well, you can just borrow from that Social Security Trust Fund. And they've been doing it ever since. Anyhow, Condi Rice has a legal advisor. Makes sense, right? Secretary of State should have a legal advisor. His name is John Bellinger. And he was in a debate sponsored by The Guardian, which is one of the top five major, you know, national newspapers in the United Kingdom. And I just want, before we go to your phone calls here, just want to play a very, very short clip from that conversation, from that debate between Philippe Sands of the, I believe, of the newspaper, and John Bellinger, the guy who advises Condi Rice on what's legal and what's illegal. And it's
truly bizarre.
Are there
any circumstances in which you could imagine the use of waterboarding to be consistent with international law?
Again, we've decided that, you know, we just don't want to get engaged in hypotheticals and applying the law to the facts.
Let me put it in yet another way. Could you imagine any circumstances in which the use of waterboarding on an American national by a foreign intelligence service.
One would have to apply the facts to the law, the law to the facts, to determine whether any technique, whatever it happened to be, was causing severe physical pain or suffering.
So you're willing to exclude any American going to the International Criminal Court under any circumstances, but you're not able to exclude the possibility of waterboarding being used on the United States national by a foreign intelligence service. I mean, that just strikes me as very curious.
Well, I'm not willing to include it or exclude it.
Yeah, he's so British. That strikes me as very curious. I say, what the heck are you saying? I can't believe I just heard that. And that's how an American would, you know. Speaking out of both sides of your mouth, are you, sir? Yeah. By the way, call Congress.org for the toll-free numbers for Congress, as well as the main switchboard number, which is 202-225-3121. Go to callcongress.org. Dennis Kucinich tomorrow is going to try to push forward his move to impeach Mr. Cheney and ultimately Mr. Bush, worthy of noting to your members of the House of Representatives. This is something that happens in the House, not the Senate. So you call your congressman or congresswoman. And also, Mr. Mukasey, we've got the senators, Democratic senators Feinstein and Schumer recently caved on this. I understand the political calculus here. I understand that having interim people filling the job who are probably even worse than Mukasey is a bad situation. I understand Bush will send somebody worse over and over and over again. I understand that you know, Mukasey, if he were to say, yes, waterboarding is torture, then he would be obligated to prosecute people within the administration that's putting him forward. So it's really an impossibility that he would even say that, or a virtual impossibility. You know, I understand all that. And I still think it's a shame that these senators are caving in. If they would just take a stand and say, yes, we know that actually in real politics, you know, in Henry Kissinger terms, that probably the appropriate political thing to do right now is to say, okay, Mukasey is better than somebody who's not as good. He's better than what everybody else that Bush might send us. He's not what we want on this particular topic, but we're going to put him in. I understand the political equation. I understand the practicality of it. But the reality is that most Americans, it's completely lost on them. Most Americans are not paying attention at that level. They don't have that level of political sophistication. And frankly, they don't care. They just know that this guy supports torture or is unwilling to condemn torture. And that now you've got Democratic senators saying, okay, fine, we're going to make him the attorney general. And if the Democrats want to win elections, if the Democrats want to stand for something, they need to stand for something, even when it's uncomfortable, even when it's difficult, even when it makes things not work. And so I personally am very disappointed that these senators are going along with this and are apparently going to vote this guy out of committee and probably vote to confirm him on the floor of the House. I think it's a shame. And I've let my senators know, and I encourage you to do the same. Again, if you go to callcongress.org, it's just a little page on our website that has all the toll-free numbers for Congress. If you know of any more, you know, let me know. There's contact information there. And you just call Congress if you're not sure who your member of the House of Representatives is, or for that matter, if you're not sure who your senators are. You know, no blame. A lot of people don't know. If you simply tell them what state you live in, they'll tell you who your two senators are. Tell them what your zip code is. They will tell you who your member of the House of Representatives is, and then they will connect you because that's the main switchboard in Washington, D.C. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, Dick in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Dick, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, you know, the historic analogy of the obstruction of justice with Carter's reelection by Reagan and Casey, and then later with Iran-Contra, I think it shows what happens, you know, when such criminality is not checked by our media and allowed to prevail. I mean, we saw it before with the Kennedy assassination cover-up that brought us Vietnam, and more recently the presidential election thefts in 9/11, which brought us the Iraq War. So I think that's why it's so graphically why it's so important to stop these political crimes instead of going along with their cover-ups and you know, we wind up with Pottersville or something worse, you know, if you don't check these things at the time.
Absolutely right, and it really started with Jerry Ford. Thank you, Dick. I mean, you know, Jerry Ford pardoning Nixon set an absolutely horrific precedent. It never should have been done. Excuse me. Never should have been done. And terrible and wrong thing. Jack in San Diego, California. Hey, Jack.
Yesterday, Musharraf delivered a speech in which he compared himself to Abraham Lincoln.
I know, by suspending habeas corpus. He says he's doing it in order to hold the Republic together. We're going to be talking about that, actually, in the next hour. If we can make our international phone lines work, we're going to be talking with a reporter in Pakistan.
Tom, and this is a speech that could only have been written by Karl Rove, a speech probably intended for George Bush, a speech that Bush may still give before he leaves office. And I just want to say that there's a move going on right now in the Pentagon to consolidate the power of all these private security firms. And I believe that if Bush was to ever declare martial law, he would use these firms like Titan and Custer's Battle and Blackwater to enforce the martial law. Is something we need to be aware of. And they're actually looking at a group called Aegis out of Britain. That they make no bones about it, that they are a mercenary group, that they will have oversight over these private security forums inside the United States.
Yeah. No, I am familiar with what you're talking about, Jack, and it does concern me. I'm not ready to go off, you know, on the hair on fire screaming edge of it, but I agree with you that we all need to be looking at this very carefully. I suspect, I mean, we're watching right now this incredible blowback. Musharraf has thrown into prison some 1,500 people so far that we know of. You know, odds are it's probably thousands. Protesters, his political enemies. He shut down television. He shut down landline communications for a while. He's got the members of the Supreme Court under guard. He immediately put the army around the Supreme Court building and then escorted them home. And all of their homes are under military guard, and their phone lines have been cut. And you know, could it happen here in the United States?
I think
the odds are slim, but I would not say that it could not happen here in the United States.
Well, Tom, here's what we need to be looking at. We need to get past the propaganda of the Bush administration. This is an administration that supports dictatorships like Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. They also lend foreign aid to India, Pakistan, and Israel. These are three countries with nuclear weapons that refuse to join the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty.
Right.
As they continue to proliferate, and the United States continues to aid and abet them in this process, these are three countries that have threatened and attacked their neighbors.
Yeah, well, at least one of them.
Hasn't India and Pakistan threatened each other with nuclear?
Oh, certainly, yeah.
Attacked Lebanon and recently Syria? And ongoing attacks on the Palestinians.
Yes, and you could argue that those attacks are defensive. But you know, your point is well made, Jack. That these guys are not you, okay. Yeah, your point is well made. These guys are not signatories to the Nuclear Proliferation Agreement. And you know, so why are we helping them? Why are we giving why are we taking mangoes from India in exchange for nuclear technology? Hack in Oklahoma City. Got about a half a minute before the break machine is going to start here. Hack, what's up?
Hey, what's going on? O'Reilly actually made that argument? I mean, does anybody...
No, it was a spoof site.
I'll tell you, after all, this is faux news. We manipulate, you comply.
Well, see, that's the thing. I mean, it, what's so amazing is you can, like, read The Onion, or you can read satire sites, or like this, you know, ptsd.blogspot.com with all the dashes between the PTSD, and you read them and you go, huh, could be. I mean, the first time I read it, I thought, oh, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. And then you get it, you know, I mean, that's how bizarre reality has become, that a spoof site sounds real, because the real stuff that this administration, well, like Bellinger here claiming, if waterboarding, I don't know if we do that or not. Would you want an American to be waterboarded? Oh, well, can't have that. 45 minutes past the hour.
Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. Thursday, November 8th, Thursday of this week, here on this program, we're going to have both sides, pro and con, on the 9/11 truth debate. Kevin Ryan, the co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, and Michael Shermer of Skeptic Magazine are going to be having at it. I will be moderating that. And yes, I've gotten probably 100 emails from people saying, no, I should be the one speaking. we're trying to do our best here, folks. And I think this is going to be a great debate. Cracking the Code is available at 35% discount at Powell's Bookstores and online at powells.com, just as a heads up. And I will be doing a whole bunch of events around. This is my new book out called Cracking the Code. On the 5th, that's tonight, I'll be at Powell's Bookstore in Portland at 7:30 p.m. On the 9th, that's Friday of this week, we will be in Tempe for our listeners in Phoenix. You have to buy tickets in advance for this, and the tickets are available for sale at the website 1480kphx.com. On the November 12th, I'll be in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania at the White Dog Cafe, 6 o'clock for dinner, 7:30 for a talk on Cracking the Code. That's on Sansom Street in Philadelphia, November 12th. November 13th, I'll be at the Strand Bookstore in New York City. That's also going to be televised by C-SPAN for Book TV. Again, the Cracking the Code. That'll be at 7 p.m., the Strand on Broadway in New York City. On the 14th in New York, I'll be at Demos, a network for ideas in action, giving a speech on Cracking the Code, 5:30 p.m. And on November 16th in San Francisco, on Green 968 a.m., Little Fox Theater in Redwood City from 3:30 till 6. More information, go to quakeradio.com. On the 17th, we'll be at the Pilgrim's Way Bookstore in Carmel, California. And on the 29th of November in Los Angeles at 7:30 p.m. at Barnes & Noble. So a lot coming up. Just a quick heads up of the list. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Chris in Rochester, New York. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to add to your list of Reagan fallacies.
Okay.
You know, like Reagan took Iraq off the terrorist list, state-sponsored terrorist list. Reagan sent the Army intelligence officers into the Kurdish area to prove that the Iranians had gassed the Kurds. He took the solar panels off the White House and gutted all the energy independence research and put us on this course that we're on now.
Yeah, absolutely. That was my point. Had Reagan not been elected, had Jimmy Carter been reelected, and right up until the last week or so, the last few weeks, as the hostage crisis played out and there was the unsuccessful attempt to rescue the hostages, right up until that point, everybody assumed Jimmy Carter was going to become president, and Reagan was viewed by and large as a crackpot. In fact, his vice president had called his economic policies voodoo economics. Zeph in North Hollywood, California. Hey, Zeph.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I always thought that Bush, the junior, the guy we got now for president, was instructed by his father and those associates and cronies to take the White House and steal the White House specifically to cover up the deeds of his father and Reagan during the previous 12 years.
Yeah, I don't disagree, and that's one of the things he did. You know, variations on the Presidential Records Act and the executive orders, locking down all that stuff from the Bush-Reagan era. Absolutely, absolutely. I think Zeph, you're spot on, and I think that's why his father had his friends on the Supreme Court make his son president, because we have to keep in mind that I'm starting to think that maybe I should refer to him as King George III. He is our third George to be president, and he thinks he's a king and Lord Vader. Anyhow, King George and Lord Vader, he was not elected. He was appointed by the Supreme Court, and we should just, you know, point that out. Tomas in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Tomas.
How you doing there, man?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
You know, I have to go against you on your analysis of the casualties going down in Iraq there, buddy. I mean, you know, it was the whole world knows they went in for a surge, and now the casualties are going down. And that violence that you talked about where 50-some people died, that was because Mukada lost control of his militias, not because he had control.
So, interesting.
You know.
Yeah. Well, the big thing is now, I mean, we have 4.5 million people in Iraq who are displaced. It's the second largest refugee crisis in the world behind Darfur. And of course, when you ethnically cleanse a neighborhood, as is what has happened all across Iraq, entire communities, entire cities, entire large chunks of Baghdad, you ethnically cleanse an area, you're going to decrease the ethnic violence because you don't have people who hate each other, who are having the hatred of each other whipped up among them, living next to each other. So there's that. Plus, Sadr's declaring a 6-month ceasefire That's, let's see, that would be August, September, October, November, December, January, February. So in February, I guess that's going to expire, although solder could do anything. But, you know, you look at all these things, none of this has to do with the surge. I mean, Bush, we are not fighting a war in Iraq. That's the bottom line. The war was long over. The war was over when Bush correctly declared that the war was over. I mean, you know, it was just that was it. You know?
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
And that was the end of the war, and it has been an occupation ever since then. It's been a very badly done occupation. It's been an occupation that's being done on the backs of 4.5 million, not to mention all the others who have been killed, perhaps 1 million dead Iraqis, 4.5 million displaced Iraqis, just an absolute horrific situation. Pete in Bronx, New York. Hey, Pete.
Hey, how are you? You know, I wanted to ask about Harriet Myers, but first I wanted to say that we need you to step up and run for office.
No, you don't.
Oh, come on.
I think I do talk radio pretty good, and there's this old saying, you know, do what you do well, and I like writing, and I like doing talk radio, and I have tremendous respect for people who run for public office, but it's just not in my blood. So I think I can help best with the electoral process by, for example, you know, as we get into the election time this coming year, we will be doing the same thing we did 2 years ago, putting candidates for office, doing our Taking Your Country Back segments, things like that. Got about a half a minute here before we've got a break, Pete. What's up?
Well, tell me what these gutless bureaucrats are going to do about Myers thumbing her nose and not showing up.
Well, this is, again, where I think that we need to be contacting our senators and our members of Congress and saying,
and I have a million times.
Please enforce these subpoenas. Well, we need to just keep at it and visit them when they come into the district and talk to the people in the local party. And, I mean, the grassroots have to explode. I mean, that's the bottom line. The grassroots has to say, you know, it overwhelmingly across America, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. You know, we really need a Howard Beale moment in this country. And or a sustained one that lasts over a period of months. And I feel it building. I really do. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Well, Bill Moyers said it. He said, take your head out of your hands, cease your wailing and gnashing of teeth. Democracy may be on the ropes, battered and bruised, but there is hope in these pages. The pages he's referring to, Losing Our Democracy, the title of the book. The subtitle, How Bush, the Far Right, and Big Business Are Betraying America and How to Stop It. Its author, Mark Green, who is also co-author of the New York Times bestseller, The Book on Bush, and also, by coincidence, president of Air America Radio, on the line with us, or actually in the studio in New York. I'm in the studio in Portland. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Next to Bill Moyers, you're among the greatest small-D Democrats in the country. I'm honored to be quoted by him and interviewed by you.
Well, and let me praise the book. I just, this is a marvelous book. In it, you go through basically how our democracy has been stolen. Before we get into that in a lot of detail, I would like to just ask you about the Democracy Protection Act, which seems to be more the call for action of all of this.
Look, I didn't just want to write about how, if you connect the dots, what Bush is up to ultimately is he wants to rhetorically export democracy while he sabotages it again and again, day after day, at home. But that complaint is one that many people have now figured out. You have so brilliantly done every 3 hours every day about it. You're up by and for the people program. But I wanted a solutions end. I didn't want to just throw up your hands, like Bill Moyers said. So I got together with the Brennan Center for Legal Justice and Mike Waldman, Katrina Vandenhoevel and The Nation magazine, Miles Rappaport at a great pro-democracy group, Demos. All three are in New York, within blocks of each other. And the four of us put together a Democracy Protection Act. I did it on behalf of the New Democracy Project and Lauren Strayer. And we had a conference in December at NYU with Bill Moyers. And we list 40 ways, not just to complain about, to actually repair the democracy, from same-day voting registration to a way to Congress automatically object to so-called presidential signing statements, how to end torture, not habeas corpus, how to strengthen the Freedom of Information Act, create a living wage. All these things, Tom, go to how to make our country more fair, so everybody has a shot at speaking or earning in our in what should be our open democracy.
Very well said. We're talking with Mark Green, the author of the now out in paperback new book, Losing Our Democracy, How Bush, the Far Right, and Big Business Are Betraying America and How to Stop It. And Mark, that's your call for action, and it's a brilliant one, and it's really solid. The first half of your book, or the first two-thirds of your book, though, is a chronicling of how our liberties, you know, starting out with voter suppression, then, you know, taking our liberties away. In fact, you have a series of, you know, what rule of law, manipulation by the media, information manipulation. How do we get to your 40-point solution in such a highly corrupted environment?
Well, first you pay $15.95. I mean, that's step one.
In other words, read the book.
Yeah. Then you read the first 280 pages. Look, I was gulled in a way like so many Americans. I'm obviously a serious Democrat and was all out for Al Gore in 2000. Okay, so Bush wins by one vote, and you know the vote. But
yeah,
I think to myself, well, maybe he'll be a Gerald Ford, George Herbert Walker Bush, Republican, conservative, but center-right in the mainstream, as he was a governor when he worked across the aisle with the Democratic leadership in Texas.
Except that Texas has a weak governorship.
Correct.
But you're right. That is how he campaigned as a moderate guy.
And interestingly, the name Bush until now, because it was not as conservative as Reagan, when Reagan and Bush ran against each other in 80, Bush seemed like the moderate. Well, they have governed not from the vital center. They are in the extreme, not the mainstream. And if you add up all the violations of law, secrecy, suppression of voting rights, falsehoods, and I'm not saying that as a partisan. I mean, if you make certain statements about Iraq or Social Security and they're provably false, you're polluting the well of democracy. If you don't believe in the separation of church and state and you have a speed dial to Jerry Falwell when he was around, and if you talk about free speech and wave the flag while you call any dissenter a traitor, suppressing speech, if you add all this up, it is the opposite of, to date, the best definition of democracy, which is Lincoln's of, by, and for the people. Tom, one other best definition. I saw a sign on 19th Street in Manhattan, where I live, in a clothing store. It said, democracy is like sex. It works best when you participate.
Yeah, it's
I agree.
True.
I agree.
It's true. I mean, that's my call to action every single day is get out there and get
active.
I hope
the FCC didn't hear that.
I think it's acceptable. We're talking with Mark Green. His new book out in paperback now, Losing Our Democracy, How Bush, the Far Right, and Big Business Are Betraying America and How to Stop It. There's also a website, newdemocracyproject.org, that has some more information on this. Mark, you in chronicling the crimes of the Bush administration, and really, I think it's really important to all of us to step back from this and realize that it's not just Bush. Bush is not running for re-election. This is an entire Republican machine that has been taken over by these far-right extremists. What do you see as the most serious crimes, and what do you see as over the short term, the ways that we may be able to put into place some stopgaps, slow down the process of the destruction of democracy in the United States?
Look, I wish the Civil Rights Division of Justice were more interested in prosecuting voter suppression cases than voter fraud cases. Mm. But I guess you could have a debate on what's worse in America. I know I think our side would win. I wish that the Medicare Drug Reform Act wasn't such a big giveaway to the drug companies. But I guess you could have a debate. What's not debatable is when a president doesn't only use Nixon's rhetoric, but Nixon's theme, that if the president does it, it's not illegal.
Right.
As, of course, Richard Nixon said on David Frost, famously or infamously. And so when President Bush, and especially Vice President Cheney, who has a monarchical sense of America that he is admitted to as a congressman and he's acting out now as a vice president, when they say, 1978 wiretapping law, we can spy on Americans, but only if they're speaking to a foreign agent and we get a warrant from a so-called FISA court. The Bush people said, we don't need that law. It's outdated. By the way, Tom, for a 1978 law to be outdated, while they keep talking about original intent from 1789 United States Constitution, I find interesting. Yeah. So when you go, basically what they've done is wave the bloody shirt, excuse me, of 9/11, and as important as that day was, and I know, like a lot of New Yorkers, exactly what it meant, 9/11 is not more important than the United States Constitution. I'm sorry. And when you elevate the Bible above the Constitution, that's fine in church or synagogue if you choose, or in your home, but not if you're a public official. And they have so blended plutocracy and theology and the willful violation of criminal law. You know, it's a felony to violate the 1978 FISA law. These people should be not just voted out of office. They should be prosecuted. And, Tom, this came up this week with the Mukasey nomination that you've spoken so well about on the Tom Hartman show. He now will be confirmed. We have now an attorney general who said a president doesn't have to obey the law and maybe waterboarding is torture. This is not the country I grew up in.
Yeah, same here. And, well, as
Nick said, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
Yeah, okay, that's kind of the essence of it all. And so, short of the election, I mean, you know, we have 441 days, 10 hours, 39 minutes, 7 seconds until George Bush leaves office voluntarily. What are the steps, short term, that you would encourage people to take to reverse this process?
Well,
we're talking with Mark Green, by the way, the author of Losing Our Democracy.
Ultimately, look, I interviewed John Kerry, Tom, last weekend on our show, 7 Days in America. Mm-hmm. And as he's struggling to figure out how to preempt, to use a verb, Bush and Cheney from attacking Iran using the same rhetoric and mischief that they used to attack Iraq. You know, gee, he said a resolution. Is it a binding resolution? They can ignore it, the War Powers Act. And I'm thinking, boy, is this sad. The person I'm speaking to, who I supported early for president,
mm-hmm. Me too,
fell 60,000 votes short of having to lobby himself. He wouldn't have to be a marginal person on the Iran issue, as we all are, because of how radical Bush and Cheney. The point I said to myself was, it's time to elect a president who, whether you think Hillary or Obama or Edwards or Biden are slightly better than the other, we could have a healthy debate. But any Democrat succeeding this administration will surrender some of the monarch-like powers that Bush and Cheney have absorbed to themselves. Won't just attack countries on bad information despite UN rules. It's all about the election.
Yeah. So the bottom line is we need to get politically active at the grassroots and make this election happen and happen big.
I think that we could get toward 58 seats in the Senate, which is a de facto cloture.
Yeah.
We could increase to 260 House seats, as it was 20 years ago, and elect a president. If we do that, Bush Cheney may be prosecuted, but they won't be forgotten.
Yeah, well said. Mark Green, the author of Losing Our Democracy, How Bush, the Far Right, and Big Business Are Betraying America and How to Stop It. NewDemocracyProject.org, some more information over there. But the book Losing Our Democracy, a brilliant read. Mark Green, thanks so much for being
with us. Thank you. Keep it up, Tom.
You too. You too, sir. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Nothing on but the radio. Feel the music playing soft and slow. You and me and the last download. We're nothing on but the radio.
21 minutes past the hour. Interesting, got a note here from Chantrey. In the last election, 4 years ago, the Bushies, actually this is Karl Rove, characterized John Edwards as, quote, the JFK from the South, Bill Clinton without the scandal. Karl Rove also had some people going through all of John Edwards' connections with law firms to try and dig up dirt against Edwards because they were worried about him the most. In a poll done by PBS, by the People, their By the People study, this was in the last election, this is 4 years ago, they found that Edwards would have beat George Bush by 11 points, whereas 48-37, whereas Kerry would have tied him 47-47. Did you say we have the guest? Chris. Okay. I don't see him on the board. Oh, okay. Great. With us is Mumtaz Ahmad. Are you there, sir?
You well.
Ah, thank you very much. Am I pronouncing your name right, Mumtaz Ahmad?
Yes.
And you are a professor of political science at Hampton University, currently visiting faculty member at the International Islamic University in Islamabad, and we are talking with you live now from Pakistan. Thank you for being with us, sir.
Sure.
Can you tell us what's going on from your point of view in Pakistan?
Well, as you know, that the emergency has been declared, constitution has been suspended, and certain fundamental changes have been made at the judicial level. So the political process that had been started a few months earlier with a view to the restoration of full democracy in three phases seems to have been suspended. So that's what is the situation now here.
Do you? I'm curious about the possibility of a counter coup. What might happen with Pakistan's nuclear weapons, and also whether this might be something that Musharraf did. You know, is there some outside of his simply losing personal power? You know, to possibly an electoral process or Benazir Bhutto or whatever. Is there actually some rationale for this? In as much as the Taliban is, you know, in the northwestern districts of the country, a very strong Al Qaeda seems to be growing in Pakistan. I mean, you know, to what extent is the rationale for this justified in the opinion, in either your opinion or the opinion of most people there, and versus this is just, you know, one guy off on a, you know, I'm going to keep my power thing.
Okay. So many questions. Let's begin. I think President Musharraf addressed the nation yesterday, and he listed several things which he said justified his declaration of emergency. People here do understand the gravity of the deteriorating law and order situation in the country and the open revolt against the state authority by some religious fanatics in the northern areas. And people also are concerned about the rise of religious extremism and militancy. But I don't think anyone believes that the declaration of emergency is going to solve any of these problems. People are convinced that these problems can be solved only through peaceful, democratic process and the process of transition to democracy should have been given a chance.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that protesters, small-D Democrats, activists, whatnot, are being rounded up and arrested in large numbers. As a professor of political science and a faculty member there at the university, are you concerned for your own safety? And is this, I mean, is there a sense of fear across the board in Pakistan? Or is it, you know, I was in Thailand, for example, during a military coup, and it didn't seem to the average person like it was happening. What's it like there?
No, I don't think anyone is personally concerned about one's safety, except, of course, there are occasional terrorist attacks and suicide bombing here and there. That is random. But Pakistani military coups are quite unlike the military coups that used to take place in Latin America a couple of decades ago. Most of the time, the Pakistani military coups or any sudden transfer of power is bloodless. No, the reaction against the imposition of emergency so far has come only from the lawyers' community. Political parties have criticized the move but have not shown any capacity of defiance. And for one thing, many of the vocal critics of the government have been either detained or have been put under house arrest. But people in general, I believe, may not be happy with the recent turn of events, but I don't think they are in a mood of mass defiance.
Yeah, or a widespread sense of crisis. We only have about 10 seconds left, sir. I'm just curious, do you think that this is going to have a good outcome?
Pardon? Could you say it again, please?
What do you think the ultimate outcome of this is going to be? And we just have a few seconds left. I'm sorry.
Well, it's maybe too early to predict. But my gut feeling is that there is a resentment, but the resentment may not translate into any speech marches or protests, and I think much will depend on the behavior of the political parties, how they will react to this development.
Mumtaz Ahmad, thank you so much for being with us today, sir.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 86.
Now I might be old-fashioned, but I believe it's true that folks around the world are pretty much like me and you. I have the
the silly notion if we want them to be friends. They prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a
yeah,
liberal.
We just believe in the liberal ideals that this country was founded on. I mean, sorry. By the way, tomorrow John Bolton will be here. Former U.N. ambassador Laura Flanders also is going to be here on her new book, Contenders. And Thursday, November 8th, on this show, we'll be taking up both sides, pro and con, of the 9/11 truth debate. Kevin Ryan and Michael Shermer debating that. Cracking the Code, my new book. It's available 35% discount at Powell's Bookstores and online, powells.com. Tonight, I'll be signing it at Powell's Bookstore here in Portland at 7:30 p.m. On the 9th, on Friday, from 3 to 5 p.m. in Phoenix, 1480 KPHX, our Phoenix affiliate, is putting on a gig at the Harkins Theater. That's 1480kphx.com. In Philadelphia on the 12th, I'll be at the White Dog Cafe, dinner at 6, talk on Cracking the Code at 7:30. On November 13th at 7 p.m., we'll be at the Strand Bookstore in New York City, signing the book and doing a riff on that. On November 14th in New York, I believe Mark Green is going to be there also. Demos, a Network for Ideas in Action, I'll be speaking there at 5:30 p.m. On November 16th, Green's 960 a.m. San Francisco, putting together a gig at the Little Fox Theater, Redwood City. We did this about 6 months ago. Worked really, really well. 3:30 to 6 p.m. Should be a lot of fun. More information, quakeradio.com. On November 17th, Pilgrim's Way Bookstore, Carmel, California. And at the end of the month, November 29th, we'll be in Los Angeles at Barnes & Noble, 7:30 p.m. on 3rd Street, the 3rd Street Promenade. And more information as we get closer to that, and December coming up as well. Al Gore said it so well. I mean, this is just absolutely, this needs to be said so often. NBC's Today Show this morning, I believe it was Meredith Vieira, she was interviewing Al Gore. And she mentioned that there was this right-wing crank who wrote an op-ed piece for the Wall Street Journal. And he calls her out on it. And it's just great. Here it
you
is.
You share the prize with scientists from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And one of those scientists, John Christie, wrote an op-ed last Thursday in the Wall Street Journal in which he criticized your dire predictions about the impact of global warming. He wrote, "I see neither the developing catastrophe nor the smoking gun proving that human activity is to blame for most of the warming we see." So what do you make of his assessment?
So here now, Al Gore. First of all, he's going to take on John Christie, the guy who wrote the op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal. And secondly, he's going to take on Meredith Vieira, and I think that's the best part of it.
Well, he's an outlier. He no longer belongs to the IPCC, and he is way outside the scientific consensus. But Meredith, part of the challenge the news media has had in covering this story is the old habit of taking the on the one hand, on the other hand approach. There are still people who believe that the Earth is flat. But when you're reporting on a story like the one you're covering today, where you have people all around the world, you don't search out for someone who still believes the Earth is flat and give them equal time. And the reason the IPCC was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, the thousands of scientists who make up that group have for almost 20 years now created a very strong scientific consensus that is as strong a consensus as you'll ever see in science, that the climate crisis is real, human beings are responsible for it, the results would be very bad for the United States and for the entire world community, all human beings, unless we do something about it, and there is still time to solve it.
So, you know, there it is. The IPCC has been studying this since 1988. And their February consensus, unequivocal, that this is happening and very likely the result of human activity. So, good on you, Al Gore. Once again, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Hutch in Paterson, New Jersey, listening to WWRL. Hey, Hutch.
Hey there, Tom. It's so wonderful to hear you again.
Thank you.
And although I have to tell you, Tom, it is a does give you pause when the ad guy says, "Get screwed by Tom Hartman."
Yeah, well, he's not saying that anymore. Now we're promoting our book, Cracking the Code.
Okay, great. So. Well, listen, my friend, I have some terrific hard news for you and everybody today. Everybody listening, stand by this evening, 7:30 p.m. You can all make a phone call and listen to Dennis Kucinich. He's calling the country tonight on the telephone. And so everybody grab your pen and take this number down. And if you call in around 7:28 this evening, that's New York time, you can hear Dennis talk for about 5 minutes, I reckon.
Hutch, I'm going to let you give the phone number out in just a second, but the odds are most people, you know, a lot of people driving in their cars listening to the radio. If there's a website that's easily remembered, that'll work a whole lot better.
Then
I'm guessing
sure
Kucinich.us is it, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, go to our website, impeachthem.com.
Okay. And that'll work better than giving out a phone number. I just, you know, having done this for years, I'll tell you.
Of course, thank you. And let me tell you, Tom, there's a lot of action, as you know. Dennis is forcing impeachment on Tuesday in the House.
Yeah, I mentioned that earlier in the show and suggested people go to callcongress.org and get one of the toll-free numbers and call Congress.
And folks, when you go to our website, impeachthem.com, we have a flyer, and we provide for you 8 toll-free numbers you can use to call every member of Congress. Of course, you want to call your own members in your district first. But really, we're all Americans. Call everybody in Congress and say, vote against tabling Dennis's bill. That's what the Republicans are going to try to do. They're going to try to kill it.
Right. Not just the Republicans. The Republicans and a whole bunch of Democrats.
Well,
and I agree. And that's why I think it's so important that we be calling the Democratic members as well.
Unfortunately, you're absolutely right.
Hutch, you want to toss that number out real quickly, and then I got to move along to the next caller.
Okay, yes. Impeachthem.com. We got a big thing in Princeton tonight, and town hall meetings are happening all over the country. So go to impeachthem.com, get hooked up, and save our country.
Okay, Hutch, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. George in Canoga Park, California. Hey, George.
A couple side tips. Carl Rowe and Gonzalez, I'm sure, are the usual suspects are in the background, or should I say the invisible suspects, and probably Scooter Libby's advising them too, and maybe even Rumsfeld.
As far as I know, still has his office and about 35 staff people in the Pentagon right now.
Yeah, right. Doesn't he still have an office there?
That's what I said. To the best of my knowledge, he still does, yeah.
That's what I heard.
I know he certainly did as of a month or so ago.
As far as canonizing Ronald Reagan, he's one of our worst presidents, and this guy's going to go down as even worse than him. And the fact is that I don't see how they can get away with it except for the media going along with it and not really revealing the truth about him.
And that's the issue. I mean, that's the issue. You've got the issue is that we now have infotainment in the United States, George, instead of news. And infotainment requires access to politicians, and politicians threaten to cut off access as a way of terrifying and controlling the media. And it's just absolutely wrong. And speaking to that issue, by the way, for our listeners listening on Talk 1090 in Seattle, this Friday night at the Seattle Town Hall from 4 p.m. to 11 p.m., there will be an FCC hearing on these issues. And you may want to drop by and check that out. So just a quick tip on that. Gene in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Gene, excuse me.
Hi, I'm concerned about these casualty numbers coming out of Iraq. Shortly before these lower numbers came out, the Bush administration had changed its policy on how they counted casualties, and yet I've never seen any analysis on how the numbers would be shaping up if they had used the old number counting system.
That's a good point. You mean the thing where if somebody's shot in the front of the head, it's a crime. If they're shot in the back of the head, then it's a combat fatality, that kind of thing?
Right.
Yeah.
So, I would like a heads up on that sort of thing for people who are in the know, because it's very confusing to me, and I'm still not convinced that the surge is working.
Well, I don't think the surge had, the escalation, let's call it what it was, really had anything to do with anything. I mean, the three big areas that seem to have led to a decrease, to the extent that there may have been a decrease in sectarian violence, are number one, ethnic cleansing has happened to a large extent. And, communities are being highly segregated, so there's less conflict in a segregated community, number one. Number two, Muqtada al-Sadr has declared a ceasefire. He runs arguably the second largest army in Iraq, maybe third behind the contractors. And number three, you've got the Sunnis, who had been formerly associated with Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party, who had been among the most violent, fighting against us, who we've reached out to. 2 years ago, they reached out to us, and finally 2 years later, we said, okay, we'll talk to you. And we're now arming them and helping them purge from their own ranks those people who were blowing us up. And so now, you know, it used to be the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Well, now our former enemies are our friends, and now our soldiers are teaching and training and giving weapons to the very people who are killing our soldiers just 3 months ago. And as a consequence, fewer soldiers are being killed. You add all that together, and that's what I think is going on. Gene, thanks for the call. I've got to move along. David in Granby, Mass. David, we've got just a few seconds before this break. What's up?
Thanks. It's good to talk to you. I try to follow a few of the progressive blogs. And when you were talking with Mark Green earlier about getting involved in politics, I'm always disturbed and kind of amazed when I go to the comment sections on these blogs at the number of people who are self-described progressives who swear up and down that they will never vote for Hillary Clinton, that they will sit out the election rather than vote for her.
Yeah, it's the circular firing squad. It's like, watch me shoot myself in the foot. I absolutely agree with you, David. The thing that you have to keep in mind when you're looking at the comment section on a blog is that it tends to be the people who are the most outspoken. It's by no means any kind of reasonable or broad scale referendum on what's actually being said. You know, that said, a lot of people have a lot of concerns about Hillary. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, 9.5 minutes before the hour. George Bush giving Brian Lamb, the founder of C-SPAN, a Presidential Medal of Freedom earlier today. And this is fascinating because George Bush talked about...
For 30 years, the proceedings of the House of Representatives have been televised, unfiltered, uninterrupted, unedited, and live.
And he goes on about, you know, isn't this a wonderful thing? Well, the fact of the matter is that C-SPAN is there because... the cable companies and the satellite companies wanted to use our rights of way, even though they don't use our frequency spectrum like radio and television stations do. They wanted to use public rights of way, and they wanted to use the commons. And so the Congress said, if you're going to use the commons, you have to pay for it. And because they couldn't quantify it in terms of dollars, like now that they're auctioning off frequency, they said the way that you pay for it is by providing people with access to what's really going on in Washington, D.C. C-SPAN is required. All of the cable companies have to pay into C-SPAN an annual, essentially, tax, and C-SPAN is a public utility. Bush did not mention that, and he did not mention the fact that Republicans and conservatives have fought C-SPAN from its very beginning and to this day would like nothing better than to see the end and the destruction of C-SPAN. Speaking of the news, Ellen Ratner is with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, our C-SPAN. Hey, Ellen.
Well, yes, and of course, Brian Lamb, I think, is a great human being. But C-SPAN also does not necessarily want to release a lot of its tape to some of the websites. So, you know, yeah. there's a little bit of a mix on that one. But in general, I'm a big supporter of C-SPAN and certainly of Brian Lamb.
But my point wasn't so much that, you know, to praise C-SPAN as to point out that we have a long tradition in this country of saying if you're going to use the commons, then you have to pay back. You have to use the commons in a way that benefits everybody. And the cable companies do use the commons by using public rights of way to run their cables, roads that are maintained by our tax dollars. And they have to pay back by paying into C-SPAN. And as I said, there have been numerous attempts by particularly Republicans, but conservatives in both parties over the years to do away with C-SPAN, to water it down, to cut back on it. In fact, there was another one just about 4 months ago. There was no discussion today by Bush about the commons. Obviously, it's something he doesn't believe in, and people need to know that.
I certainly agree with you on that one. This morning, there was not a lot of discussion from the White House on the issue of Pakistan, except to say that we can't support emergency rules or the extreme measures taken during the emergency. Also, at the United Nations today, the Secretary General said that he has strong dismay, the detention of human rights and opposition activists, and Musharraf also took the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Religion and Belief. And so, I mean, it's hard to believe that they arrested that guy today as well. The president is meeting with the prime minister of Turkey and said he will have a statement on Pakistan later after the meeting.
You know, and I have a very, very strong feeling, Ellen, that if we had not invaded Afghanistan, I'm not even talking about Iraq, Afghanistan, if when the Taliban offered to give us Osama bin Laden for a trial, we had simply said, fine, give him to us for a trial, shut down the camps, and it'll be the end of al-Qaeda, he would have gone into that good night the same way Tim McVeigh did, and none of this would be happening right now.
Well, we certainly dropped the ball. There is no question on Osama bin Laden. And, I mean, one of the Democratic sites, and you probably have it on your website, I actually list the number of days that we still don't have bin Laden.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I'm thinking of starting to list the number of days since the Military Commissions Act was created. And for the first time in the history of the United States, we have now a whole third branch of the judiciary, which is completely independent from anything in the Constitution.
Well, my brother Michael will probably give you an award if you do that.
Yeah. I'm there with him.
Interesting. John Conyers today also made public another letter to, to Fred Fielding, in which he basically, I'm really sorry about that, urged compliance with these committee subpoenas that they've been saying, and he basically said he's writing one more time to seek to resolve the problem with Fielding and to get their White House cooperation on subpoenas.
Now, does this have to do with the White House emails, or is this Harriet Myers, or is this Gonzalez, or is this all of the above?
I believe it has to do with White House emails.
Okay.
On that front. Mm-hmm. And then the Supreme Court also agreed to review a death penalty case. Apparently an inmate, this guy Hoffman, had been, I guess this was in Idaho, had been offered a plea bargain. His lawyers told him not to accept it. He accepted it and was given the death sentence. And the Supreme Court is going to be taking up that again as well. Also, this week, in addition to the Mukasey nomination that we're going to be hearing about in the Senate, I believe it is tomorrow, they're also going to be taking up the bill approved by the Senate Intelligence Committee, and this is actually the Senate Judiciary Committee is also going to be taking up the Senate Intelligence Committee on the FISA Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. As you know, the huge issue on this is still whether to give retroactive immunity to telecommunications companies.
Right. Kucinich is pushing tonight. He's got a conference call tomorrow. He's pushing his impeached Cheney thing into the House, going to push it really hard. Some are saying this is a campaign stunt, trying to raise his visibility in Democratic primaries. Others are saying it's possible something might come out of it. What's your sense of this?
Well, you know, I think Dennis Kucinich is realizing he's not going to be president of the United States, and I think he's trying to move towards something that is going to be much more permanent in terms of his ability to influence policy, and I think that's a great move.
Interesting.
I mean, I don't think he'd come out and say, look, I'm not going to be president of the United States, because he's still pushing that for lots of reasons.
Well, he's been pushing it for a long time. I mean, Dennis Kucinich has always been a guy who takes principled positions.
That's right, and I think that's exactly what he's trying to do on that.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out. Ellen Ratter with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com on the web. Ellen, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Always great speaking with you. Coming up next, we're going to have an in-depth conversation with Naomi Wolf, the author of The End of America, A Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot. How is our democracy disintegrating right in front of us? And what can we do about it?
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. A couple of weeks ago, I was flying someplace. I've been doing so much of this on this book tour, I forget where and when. And I brought with me a copy of Naomi Wolf's new book, The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, as airplane reading. It's a relatively small book. It fit in my carry-on bag real easily. And you know, I get, I mean, we literally get I'm not exaggerating, a cubic foot of mail a day here, and three quarters of it is books. And there are so many excellent books out there on what's going on, you know, the crimes of the Bush administration, the, you know, the state of America, all these kinds of things. But we get many of the authors on this program as well. And I have to say, in my opinion, this book is arguably one of the most important books that's been written, certainly in the last decade or two, and perhaps in my lifetime. Naomi Wolf, the book, The End of America, A Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot. Welcome to the program, Naomi.
Thank you so much, Tom. And I just want to say we're actually not related, because that was such a glowing and lovely introduction.
You're...
I would imagine only a relative would say such nice things.
No, we're... In fact, I don't think we've ever even met.
No, but I appreciate your kind words.
Yeah, although I recall, I think that I recall a year or so ago you were on this program about cosmetics, as I recall.
Yeah, things change.
Yeah.
Things have become a lot more serious in only a year.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, first of all, you wrote this book to a friend. You want to just give us a little setup on this? How this book came about?
Sure. I have a friend whose parents are Holocaust survivors, and she kept saying to me as we looked at news events that they did this in Germany, and I really ignored her or thought that she was really exaggerating. But finally she sat me down and forced me to read some history, and I was stunned, because, of course, she wasn't talking about the later years, National Socialist outcomes. She was talking about the early years when Germany was a parliamentary democracy and there was a systematic legal assault on the Constitution and a legal subversion of the rule of law that sort of opened the door for everything to follow, as well as other kinds of intimidation of citizens. And then, Tom, I looked at other times and places where a would-be despot or dictator sought to close down an open society or crush a democracy movement, and I saw that all dictators, and we're seeing this right now in Pakistan, do the same 10 things. All people who are trying to crush a democracy do the same 10 things, whether it's Italy in the 20s, Germany in the 30s. I also looked at, democracy movements that were crushed, East Germany in the 50s, Czechoslovakia in the 60s, China in the 80s. They all do the same 10 things. They take the same 10 steps, and the horror that I came to realize is that we are seeing those exact 10 steps in place today.
Right, here in the United States. And even if they're not being used in ways that are obvious, they are being codified. They're being put into law.
They're being put into place. And what we learned, or what we've got to learn from history, and so I don't kind of look at Germany or talk about Germany lightly. I'm really talking about, I'm not being rhetorical with Nazis, I'm really being technical.
Mm-hmm.
What we've got to learn from history is that the way a democracy is closed down, especially, is incrementally. And so very, very much in terms of a thread that's common in history, what we've got now is a situation in the United States where laws have been put in place so that, like, one thread has to be pulled for it to be basically too late. They reach to the point where democracy can't heal democracy.
Unless there's a cataclysmic event like that democracy becoming a fascist state like Germany did, and then becoming a mass murder state. I mean, Hitler went way beyond fascism. He became a psychopathic mass murderer who was leading a death cult. And then that was defeated by us and the British and the Russians.
Right.
And, the incredible pain that the German people went through as a consequence of that, not to mention the victims.
Not to mention everyone else, exactly.
Yeah,
right.
Of the German people. But I lived in Germany for a year back in the 80s, and I can tell you that country is not going to heal from the wounds of what happened in the 1940s for probably another five generations, if ever.
That's exactly right. And I mean, God forbid we don't push this back in time, because you're right. We're sort of skipping ahead to kind of the end of the argument, but given the way the United States is acting right now, rendering people off the street in Macedonia and Italy with a semblance of democracy at home, can you imagine what's going to happen in the world with a violent dictatorship essentially in the United States, and it's unconstrained by democracy at home, you know, other nations will be frightened to engage with the United States in a democratic way. I mean, you know, sure. United States in a situation like that can render EU ministers off the street in Brussels, or, you know, call the head of the, you know, Greenpeace International a terrorist.
Well, I would argue this is already happening. I would argue that it has been directed in small ways against, for example, people in the animal liberation movement. Ecology, the deep ecology movement. It's almost like it's rehearsal.
It's actually even more systematic than rehearsal. It's also messaging. I mean, I would feel remiss if I didn't kind of talk quickly summarize the first four steps so people know why I'm so freaked out.
Over the course of the next 30 minutes here, I want to go through all 10 of them one at a time.
Okay, fine. In that case, let me just say that you're so right about the animal liberationists. The creepy, scary thing about the blueprint for dictatorship, and you're so right, you don't have to be a psychopathic murderer. What happened was this blueprint was developed by Hitler and Mussolini. Well, actually Mussolini and imitated by Hitler and Stalin, but then petty dictators all over the world reproduce it in less spectacular ways. All over Latin America it's reproduced. Right now in Pakistan it's being reproduced. In Myanmar it was reproduced. In Thailand it was reproduced. We teach the blueprint to the School for the Americas for would-be despots that we want to prop up in Latin America. So what is so terrifying about the blueprint is that it is predictive. Readers can tell what's going to happen 6 months from now from the blueprint, and you're so right that since I was reading Goebbels, I knew that after the Military Commissions Act of 2006 was passed, which sanctioned state torture, I knew that some of the first prisoners to be tried by the military commissions would be white and English-speaking, because there's always, in what I call a fascist shift, a blurring of the line. They start by torturing brown people or people seen as marginalized, gypsies, Jews, whatever, and society's like, fine, whatever, that's not us, we don't care. Brown people on an island with Muslim names, whatever. But there is always, always a blurring of the line, and so you're so right that it was predictable that then there would be this expanded definition of terrorist with new laws criminalizing or calling terrorist people who were committing arson for animals.
Well, and in fact, a law was just passed in the last year, I believe, maybe it was a year and a half ago, that says that economic crimes against any company that has anything to do with animals, anything that harms their economic activity, mm-hmm. causes you to be defined as a terrorist.
Right, which means that if I, you know, give someone that book, Skinny Bitches, I mean, this is kind of an extreme example, but if I promote veganism, you know, it's arguable that I'm...
Oh, if you stand out in front of a McDonald's with a Don't Buy Meat sign, under this law right now in the United States, you could be declared a terrorist, and under the Military Commissions Act, you are now subject to a brand new third form of justice. We have the Uniform Code of Military Justice for the military, and we have the Constitutional Code of Justice for the United States. Now, there's this third one under the Military Commissions Act, which I want to get into in some detail with you. We're talking with Naomi Wolf. She's the author of The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot. Let's get into this in some detail here, Naomi. The blueprint, the 10 steps. Let's just go through them one at a time. We have about 2 minutes here before we have to take a break. I think we can probably get through the first one or two. And then we'll come back after the break and continue the conversation.
Sure thing. The first thing all would-be dictators always do, Tom, is they invoke a terrifying internal and external threat. Often that threat is real and they'll hype it. Stalin talked about sleeper cells, for instance, which is a phrase that got recycled by the Bush administration, as dozens of phrases and images and tactics have been. And he terrified people, and these were like capitalist alleged terrorists, but it was totally fake. But Pinochet invoked real armed insurgents, but then used fake documents called Plan Z to say they were going to bomb all this infrastructure. And we've seen fake documents used with the yellow cake charge that led us into war against Iraq.
Now, we did, you know, John Adams did this with the XYZ affair with France in 1798. It led to the Alien Sedition Acts and
You're
allowed
so
him
right.
to shut down newspapers.
Yeah.
During the Cold War, it was communism, and that led to a lot of repression. Are we justified in being concerned that this first step really is going to end up going all the way down that road?
Oh, we are past what the Alien and Sedition Acts and the 50s called for. I mean, I make the point in the book that the 50s, the HUAC hearings, are a cakewalk compared to now, because unlike then, like what the worst people were facing then was the loss of their careers. And I would be brave and stand up to McCarthy if I was facing the loss of my career. But what we're facing right now in standing up is the possibility of 3 years in solitary confinement, because the president can call you or me an enemy combatant tomorrow.
Right. Or possibly life in solitary confinement. Or simply disappearing, you know, ending up in a torture cell in Morocco or something. Naomi Wolf is with us. Her book, The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot. Step one, she just laid out. There's 10 steps that are always followed when democracies disintegrate. We'll get into the rest of them right after this break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Well, what we're supposed to do is take back democracy in America. Step one. The infrastructure has now been put into place to end democracy in America. Let us understand what that infrastructure is, what the commonalities are with every other democracy that has failed, and how we might roll it back, how we may stop it. Naomi Wolf is with us. Her book on this topic, The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot. Naomi, you just had concluded laying out number one, establishing evoking an internal and external threat. Number two.
Number two is to create a paramilitary force that is not answerable to the people. And, of course, Mussolini pioneered this with the black shirts. Even when Italy was a parliamentary democracy, the black shirts were sent to beat up, well, people like you and me, you know, editors, journalists, activists, opposition leaders, to intimidate people voting.
Well, and Hitler did the same thing with the brown shirts. I think most Americans don't realize that Mussolini's black shirts and Hitler's brown shirts were not part of the military or, frankly, even the political apparatus. They were, in some cases, corporate goons, or in other cases they were voluntary kind of men's club groups.
Exactly, which is why our modern equivalent, which is Blackwater, is so very analogous. Most of us know that Blackwater has close ties to Homeland Security in the Bush White House. And, of course, they were responsible for a massacre of 17 civilians in Iraq. But most of us don't yet know, and we really need to wake up to the danger, that Blackwater was patrolling, invited by Homeland Security to patrol the streets of New Orleans in the wake of Katrina, and Jeremy Scahill reported on contractors firing on civilians. And I'm actually having trouble sleeping at night because every time I go out on the road, I was just in Chicago, and I found out that they've opened a facility there in the heartland. I just read in Slate that they're opening a facility along the Mexican border. Most of us don't know that their business plan calls for increased deployment in the United States in the event of a natural disaster or, quote, a public emergency. And to close the circle, the president, as of the Defense Authorization Act of 2007, now has the power unilaterally to declare a national emergency, meaning that tomorrow Blackwater could be patrolling the streets of California in the wake of the fires, or even more disturbingly, the Defense Authorization Act of 2007, or just as disturbingly, allows the president to send the National Guard of Alabama to crack down and impose basically a curfew on the residents of Illinois over the objections of the governors of both states and tell Congress about it after the fact. And since, to end the complete freak out of this, the historical blueprint does say that the months leading up to a national election are the most unstable and the most likely to see a provocation, a heights threat, an excuse for a crackdown.
And historically, the reason why militias, I mean, Jefferson wrote about the importance of local militias. The Second Amendment was a result of a compromise from people who didn't want there to be any standing army during time of, except during time of war. But that all militias should be local and under local control. And the reason why that was so important to the founders was because they realized that the local militia would never turn their guns on their own people. Hmm. But the militia from a state, you know, five states away, could turn their guns on other people with impunity because they don't know any of those people. They're not related to any of those people. There's no social bonds there.
That's really, really interesting. I've become a lot more emotionally connected to the Second Amendment and the Fourth Amendment. I didn't used to understand how they protect me physically and my family. Mm. This explains something else very scary about Blackwater. You know, we think they're Americans, but they're actually hand-selected, often Chileans, Nigerians, Nicaraguans, Salvadorans, mercenaries or paramilitary from states that practice state terror against opposition leaders, civilian citizens. They're torturers and murderers, and they're the ones that we're going to find. And I just blogged about how on their website they're looking at protests in Midtown Manhattan, and there's absolutely nothing keeping them right now from being deployed to monitor, you know, the protests that we're having tomorrow to support the Constitution in Union Square, or to help TSA agents close down the borders or manage the borders.
Right. And, in fact, now they've Eric Prince has started another company to provide corporate intelligence. We're seeing increasingly this merging of corporate and state interests, which in the 1987 American Heritage Dictionary was the definition of fascism.
Right. Right. And, yeah, no, you're right. And I guess the thing that's so depressing, I'm reading a book called IBM and the Holocaust, and by the way, it mentions Bush's grandfather's close ties.
Yeah, you're talking about the book that came out about 15 years ago?
Yeah.
10 years
right.
ago? Yeah, I read that at the time. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're so right that, I mean, in a way, the marriage of capitalism and fascism is sort of the best of all worlds for capitalism, because it's unbelievably profitable when the state is in alignment with corporations and using state terror to get its way.
Yeah, and if you don't think that's true, just look at the difference in stock price from Halliburton when Bush and Cheney came into office, when it was, as I recall, around 12, 13 to today, where it's like around 50 or 60, as I recall. It's been a long time since I've looked at Halliburton's prices, but right across the board, you're seeing all these stocks explode.
Right, and imagine what will happen to that stock if events transpire so that there really isn't going to be a change of party.
Indeed. Okay, so we're through 2 of 10 of the characteristics of the loss of a democracy. We'll cover the other 8 when we come back from this break. We're talking with Naomi Wolf, The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, a Citizen's Call to Action, extraordinary book. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program right here on Air America Radio. Stick around. Let's try and bring it back. By the way, just a quick heads up, some upcoming events. Thursday of this week, we're going to have both sides of the 9/11 debate on this program. Kevin Ryan, co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, Michael Shermer, Skeptic Magazine. My new book, Cracking the Code, available 35% discount at Powell's.com. I'll be at Powell's tonight in Portland, Oregon, 7:30, signing the book. On Friday of this week, I'll be in Phoenix. We're doing a gig at the Harkins Theater and at Arizona Mills in Tempe, 3 to 5 p.m. You have to get tickets for that at 1480 KPHX, our Phoenix affiliate, 1480kphx.com. In Philadelphia on the 12th, I'll be at the White Dog Cafe for a 6 o'clock dinner, 7:30 talk on Cracking the Code. On the 13th, 7 p.m., the Strand Bookstore in New York City. On the 14th, New York, Demos, a network for action and ideas at 5:30 p.m. On the 16th, Green 960 in San Francisco, our San Francisco affiliate, putting on a gig at the Little Fox Theater in Redwood City. I'll be there from 3:30 to 6. Information about that at quakeradio.com. And on the 29th in Los Angeles, Barnes & Noble, 1201 3rd Street Promenade, 7:30 p.m., co-sponsored by our affiliate in Los Angeles, KTALK, KTLK. We're talking with Naomi Wolf. The End of America is her book, Letter of a Warning to a Young Patriot. And Naomi, feel free to take any of the things that I said in the introduction of our conversation here and repeat them anywhere you want. I think this is one of the most important books I've ever read, and it's an extraordinary, it's absolutely brilliant, particularly in how tight it is. And speaking to that, we have about 8 or 9 minutes here left, and we've got 8 or so items to go through. So I'm just going to, you know, ask you to just start going through these things. What are the just for anybody who's just tuned in, there is a 10-step template that people, that dictators, that tyrant, whatever you want to call them, people always use when they deconstruct a democracy, whether it was Spain, whether it was Italy, whether it was Germany, whether it was Chile, whether it was Argentina. And those 10 pieces over the last 5 years, the last 10 years, have been put into place in the United States. They have not yet been activated. Naomi Wolf is with us. She's already established, number one, invoking an external and internal threat. Number two, establishing a secret paramilitary, a secondary paramilitary force and secret prisons within the country. Where do we go from there?
Yeah, well, I'll very quickly say, I mean, the secret prisons are exactly right. We've got that, and that is what allows there to be intimidation of citizens, because, as I mentioned, there's always this blurring of the line. You can't name a state that established prison system, and by secret, I mean outside the rule of law, where torture takes place that didn't end up abusing its own citizens. Then you create a surveillance apparatus aimed at ordinary citizens. You infiltrate citizens' groups. You arbitrarily detain and release citizens. I've got a section on the TSA. I was on the watch list. Then I'm back off now. Then I'm back on the watch list, as well as any number of critics of the administration. And there's a reason that lists historically are very scary to be on. The next step is that you target key individuals, people like Dan Rather, Bill Maher, the Dixie Chicks, visible individuals. They experience job loss, smears, then criminal prosecution, like this donor to Democrats in Alabama who's now in jail. It escalates, finally, physical intimidation. Then you restrict the press, and I mentioned Bill Keller, the executive editor of the New York Times, who published the FISA and Swift banking stories, and there was this drumbeat of treason, 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 try him under the Espionage Act. And since I was reading Stalin, this gave me chills, because in 1936, the publisher of Izvestia was accused of treason by Stalin, was tried in the Third Moscow Show Trial, and was, in fact, executed, just as Melanie Morgan at KGO called for the execution of Bill Keller if he was found guilty of treason. And, by the way, the invoking of the Espionage Act, I'm sure this is dear to your heart, knowing all you do about history, Tom, or dear to your heart, yeah, I mean, you know it, and you would be horrified. Most of us don't know that the Espionage Act was last widely used to round up ordinary citizens, activists, child labor, anti-child labor activists, teachers, journalists, without warrants, and they were beaten in prison, and really dissent was crushed for a decade. Eugene Debs, under that act, got a 10-year jail sentence for giving a speech about the First Amendment.
And this was a Democratic president, by the way, Woodrow Wilson, who was responsible for implementing this.
You know, which is such an important point to bring up, Tom, because this is really not about partisanship. This is about the founders' vision, and it so transcends partisanship. I mean, the founders categorically knew that an American despot could arise in America to oppress Americans, and that human nature, whether you're whatever party, tends to abuse power if it's unchecked, and that's why they set up this beautiful system of checks and balances, which we're now seeing dismantled. And the last stage, the last step, is that you make it easier to declare martial law, or you essentially subvert the rule of law. And in the final stage, which is why I'm really like, I'm kind of talking fast because there's kind of a race against time, because everything is escalating right now. In the final stage, what you see is what we're seeing now, which is Congress keeps thinking it's engaged in democracy, but the other side just isn't engaged in democracy anymore. And this reminds me of this scene in 1920 when, Mussolini's thugs had already marched on Rome, and Parliament kept trying to negotiate with Mussolini, and they offered him four different cabinet positions, and he was just waiting, and imagine him drumming his fingers, waiting for them to realize that the time for negotiating was over. So that's what I'm seeing.
Shades of
Congress saying, but we're Congress, and the President saying, whatever, we're doing something else now.
Right. Yeah. Shades of Mukasey. Shades of today. John Conyers saying, once again, we're going to demand that you give us those emails.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And it's really time to notice that, there are criminals who have essentially staged what someone intelligent called a paper coup. I think Gore referred to the prospect as a slow motion coup. It's already happened. Yeah. And so our job is now to hold congressional hearings into this criminality. I would say impeach and prosecute.
I agree. And I think that the major piece of it began at the end of 2000 when the Supreme Court gave the presidency to George W. Bush. And I was astounded a year later when the consortium of news agencies actually counted the vote, and the New York Times buried in the 17th paragraph of the article the fact that when they actually counted all the votes in Florida, as the Florida Supreme Court had required, and that's what was stopped in the Bush v. Gore decision. When they counted all the votes in Florida, regardless of how you measured it, intent of voter, non-intent of voter, pregnant Chad, dimpled Chad, whatever, regardless of how you measured it, by any measure, Al Gore won more votes in Florida than George W. Bush. He was president, the only president of the United States to never serve as president of the United States. And that was in my mind, the coup. That was the beginning, and three of the Supreme Court justices who voted on that had family members who were working either directly or indirectly with the Bush campaign or ties to the Bush family.
Wow.
Active and legal ties at that time. But in any case, so these 10 steps, just to quickly recap, and this is just basically the table of contents of your book, invoke an internal and external threat, establish secret prisons, develop a paramilitary force, surveil ordinary citizens, infiltrate citizens' groups, arbitrarily detain and release citizens, target key individuals, restrict the press, and cast dissent, criticism as espionage and dissent as treason, and subvert the rule of law. These are the 10 items. We see all of these things in place. How do you answer folks who say, well, you know, arguably all of these things have been done before. All of these things have, you know, as I said, you know, we talked a little bit before, the 1950s and things like that. I mean, you were just talking a minute ago, Eugene Debs, you know, Woodrow Wilson throwing him in jail.
Yeah. What's different now? That's such a good question. Here's what's different. Other times of sort of hysteria and suppression were usually tied to wars, and the wars ended. There was a victory day, you know, and the war ended, and, you know, after World War II, everyone was sort of sorry they'd locked up 120,000 Japanese Americans. They apologized, you know, after the end of the Civil War. Habeas corpus was restored after Lincoln suspended it. So usually the pendulum can, I mean, always in the past, the pendulum can swing back at the end of hostilities. But this war has been defined, war, quote-unquote, other countries don't call it a war, against terror has been defined as open-ended in time. It will never end. It doesn't have to end ever. And also global in space. And so there, it will never be a point of the end of the war. So there will never be a time for it to swing back.
Right. Naomi Wolf, you point out in your book, The End of America, that there will not be a signing ceremony on the deck of a battleship like there was at the end of World War II. Because there is no place. There are no specific players. There is nobody to raise the flag and surrender on the other side.
Right. And the second difference is so key, and this has to do with torture. I mean, the United States soundbite is we don't torture, but of course, you know,
Hitler said the same thing.
People in our name, you know, even as we speak right now. And this tasering of this kid in Florida, I think, you know, it's very, very interesting. It's predictable that citizens would start to get hurt right now as they're, exerting their First Amendment rights or other rights. The enemy combatant claim, you know, that anyone, innocent American citizen, can be named an enemy combatant and locked up in a Navy brig for 3 years. This changes the whole equation because we've never had sort of state legalized torture and physical abuse of citizens before, or I would say physical abuse of citizens by the state. And so the first time I open, really the clock is ticking, Tom, because if I open the Washington Post tomorrow and see that half the reporters have been charged by the Justice Department with violations of the Espionage Act, because all of them have traded or dealt with classified information.
Naomi, hold the line for just a second, would you? Chris, can you push this break back, please, a minute and a half or so? I realize that you've got to jump through a bunch of hoops to do it, but I'd appreciate it. Naomi, because we were just the machine was just about to start the music and we would have to stop.
I would go quiet.
Yeah, no, well, that's when we have to wrap up the interview. I would submit to you that there are many African Americans who remember the 60s who would say, no, the government has used its force against us and people who are at Kent State, but it's never been quite like this. The question I have for you in this last minute that we've just carved out.
Yeah.
What can we do? What must we do?
This is what we must do. Go to AmericanFreedomCampaign.org. This is an organization we've started with 5 million members and partner organizations to drive a democracy movement to confront these abusers and restore the rule of law. The second thing is to pass this 10-point legislative agenda that's been introduced into Congress that would stabilize democracy. The third thing is we have to start holding hearings, call for hearings to look at the criminality, the crimes committed, and there are at least two kinds of crimes, crimes against federal statute by FISA and the crimes of torture, and hold these criminals accountable. History shows that it is not enough to impeach to get them out of office. People like this are not safe until they're put behind bars. And history also shows that the election is not safe unless these people are tried and investigated and held accountable first. So really the clock is ticking, but we can do it. History also shows that when millions of people rise up to confront these abusers, there's not a force on earth that can stand up against them.
Yeah, well said. Naomi Wolf, the book is The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, A Citizen's Call to Action. I encourage you to get this book and read it. This is extraordinary. Naomi Wolf, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And the website, the America Freedom Campaign. I'm also seeing, is it democracyinaction.org that flips to? Naomi? Oh, she's gone. She's offline. Okay. 46 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around. We'll be right back.
The Tom
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Tell me, George, if there's any damn way that there'll ever be a day I can get on a plane without worrying about the next maniac trying to pay me back just 'cause you're half insane. Right-wing freak judges, $200 billion grudges. Yes, war's cooked up right from day one. Big corporations are running this nation like it never was meant to be run.
52 minutes past the hour.
Yes, George,
Tom Harbin here with you. Richard Michalski is with us. Am I pronouncing that right, Richard?
That's fine.
It's fine. You want to say it right?
Just remember there's an SKI at the end.
Yeah, Richard Michalski.
Yeah.
And you are the General Vice President of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, the website goiam.org.
And, that's right.
And 44,000 American jobs on the line right now, Richard?
Yes, on this tanker deal. If we don't get it, it'll be 44,000 people left behind again.
So give us the details of this.
Well, the armed forces needs to replace their tankers. Their tankers are 50 years old. They're in disrepair. It's very expensive to maintain these tankers. The Air Force has been shopping around to do this. About 5 years ago, the Boeing was awarded the tanker deal, and what happened after that was simply it was found that there was some collusion between some Boeing executives and members of the Defense Department. As a result, those people were put in jail. The contract was canceled, and now it went up for rebid.
And is Airbus is looking at it?
Well, right now we are, Airbus has been lobbying very strongly with members of Congress, who they get along with, and have created this illusion that they can compete with a product that is superior in performance and in price.
Well, to a large extent, they probably can because they're subsidized by the countries, it's France and the UK, isn't it, who are the principal owners of Airbus?
Well, you know, in a way, Airbus and the UK, they get it. They understand that they need to create wealth for their citizens. And Airbus's mission, as it was created, was to create jobs in the aerospace industry for Europeans who contributed as a whole to create this company and subsidize its products.
Is it time for us then, Richard, to say now in America we need to have domestic content laws, or we need to have laws that say the U.S. government has to buy first and foremost from U.S. companies? And by U.S. companies, we don't mean necessarily like General Electric, which does 52% of its business outside the United States, but companies that are both domiciled in the United States and produce product in the United States?
That produce work here, add value to product here in the United States. Absolutely. There are Buy American laws in the defense appropriation bills. This administration has chose to waive all the Buy American laws. There are provisions that allow the Secretary of Defense to, for the good of the American people, to ship jobs offshore because he deems necessary. And Rumsfeld and this new secretary has the power at the direction of the President of the United States to award contracts to, in many cases, countries that don't support us politically.
Right. Yeah. Or are openly hostile to us, for that matter.
Absolutely.
And this even goes to Boeing. I mean, Boeing is making parts of their airplanes now in China.
Boeing has outsourced a lot of their work. We are supporting Boeing in this bid. We also want to hold them accountable. We have asked members of Congress, both in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, to say to the Boeing representatives, exactly where are you going to build this plane? Exactly where are you going to, in what district of mine will a subcontractor get some of that work so that the taxpayer gets some, gets a return on this, not just in the fact that it enhances the defense of the country.
Right, because we're all in favor of American companies being profitable in America with American workers.
Well, there's nothing wrong with us making a buck.
There you go. Nothing wrong with it at all. Richard Michalski, he is the General Vice President of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, the website goiam.org. And, Richard, thanks so much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you.
And keep up the great work. We need our unions here in America. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging Ambassador John Bolton on his new book, John Bolton. Laura Flanders will be here as well. That and your calls in the news. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.